You are not the president or the vice president's lawyer.
He won a case, a big case.
Your loyalty is not to me.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many.
It's to the law.
Well, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly.
The Constitution.
He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney.
People of this nation to guarantee justice.
Which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast formerly known as All the President's Lawyers, about all of President Trump's legal issues and those of other people in his orbit. But now the show is called All the President's Lawyers, because it's about all the legal issues of at least two presidents, former President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden. All presidents have legal problems. Some presidents have more legal problems than others. My co-host is Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He writes the Pope Hat Report, which you can subscribe to on Substack. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So let's get to it this week. Who is Jeffrey Clark?
Jeffrey Clark is a lawyer in the United States Department of Justice who before very recently was not particularly well known. But became abruptly extremely widely known after a New York Times story suggesting that he took a real shot at helping Donald Trump with some of his crazier plans to overturn the election.
So he was the head of the Environmental Division. He became the acting head of the Civil Division. He'd been a partner at Kirkland & Ellis. Now, that's a serious, like, real law firm where you're not supposed to come up with crazy harebrained schemes, right?
It is. And to his credit, a number of people of substance who have known him well in the past have expressed dismay and shock and suspicion that maybe the story isn't completely right, because according to them, it seems so out of character for him that in the past, he has not been a sort of Trump partisan type, but a somewhat straight-laced, perhaps a little nerdy, as some lawyers tend to be, career lawyer type.
Yeah, but both one of the news stories said that both his supporters and his detractors described him as nerdy, which is a weird situation to end up in where that's being said about you in the newspaper. But so basically, Jeffrey Clark, there was no full real attorney general. Bill Barr had left his position. Jeffrey Rosen, who had been the deputy attorney general, was the acting attorney general. And the president wanted the Department of Justice to do various things for him as part of his efforts to steal the election, and wanted DOJ to announce that there were investigations of massive fraud, and wanted the DOJ to find massive fraud, which is a problem because it didn't happen. And so when Jeffrey Rosen was basically saying no to all the president's requests here about, that the DOJ should do something to fix this fact that he lost the election, Jeffrey Clark had some ideas. He wanted the Justice Department to have some sort of press conference where they would announce that they had found, they were looking into really significant fraud in the election. He wanted them to send a letter to legislators in Georgia saying that they'd uncovered serious problems with the election in that state and that they should decertify their election result. Now, among other problems with this idea, they were discussing doing this after the electors had already voted in the Electoral College. So in addition to being unjustified, it was too late. And so basically, he had gotten to this point where he couldn't convince DOJ leadership to do these things. So he talked to the president and almost convinced the president to remove Jeffrey Rosen as acting attorney general, make him attorney general, sort of a revisitation of the Saturday Night Massacre from the Nixon administration.
Right. And what makes this more awkward is that Jeffrey Rosen used to be his supervisor and mentor when they were attorneys together at Kirkland & Ellis, which, as you suggest, Josh, is a very, normal, not psycho crazy, well-respected major law firm. So the suggestions are that, yes, he was willing to be Trump's guy to replace Jeffrey Rosen, to announce investigations of Georgia and use those investigations perhaps to pressure, not to say coerce, officials in Georgia to overturn election results there, and do some sort of not particularly well-defined and probably not reality-based application to the United States Supreme Court for assistance in overturning the election.
If Jeffrey Clark had gotten the president to go through with this, to remove Jeffrey Rosen and make him the acting attorney general, what would be different right now? I mean, this wouldn't have made Trump president. So I'm trying to figure out what the actual stakes were here for the United States if this harebrained scheme had gone forward.
Well, so it's, I think you're right. It's likely it wouldn't have changed the ultimate legal outcome, but the question is whether it would have turned up the tension even more on the situation that led to, you know, what amounted to domestic terrorism at the Capitol on January 6th, whether it would have swayed even more Republicans to sign on to these completely non-reality-based theories about how there was election fraud and how there was question who was legitimately president and so forth, whether what happened in the aftermath would have been even more catastrophic and more detrimental to sort of a shared confidence in the system.
Because I'm trying to figure out what this means for future elections that could face illegitimate contests in the United States. Because at turn after turn after turn, we saw officials who had the opportunity to try to overturn the election declining those opportunities. Now, the Republican officials were a lot more likely to sign on to efforts encouraging other people to overturn the election. So they would sign on to amicus briefs or that sort of thing, saying, you know, yeah, this Texas lawsuit is great. The Supreme Court should uphold it, that sort of thing. But I think, you know, you saw officials here in the Department of Justice, and I assume one thing that they said when they looked at this was, in addition to being, you know, against what the law says about how our elections should be conducted, if you did this, it wouldn't have worked. Georgia had already voted. Even if Georgia had not already voted, Georgia was not dispositive for the election outcome. You could have taken away Georgia's electoral votes from Joe Biden, give them to Donald Trump, and Biden still would have had a majority in the Electoral College. And so you'd be throwing away your reputation to no end. And so I guess the question is, you know, if the election result had really hinged on one thing, on one state, on the choice of one person, maybe the system would have been significantly less robust to that. I think it's hard to figure out exactly why officials like Jeffrey Rosen, who upheld the system, did they do that out of a commitment to the system, or did they do that because if they tried to break the system, they would fail?
Or a combination of both. I mean, I don't think that the system working is necessarily just a simple on-off switch. I think it's a game of inches. And here, there were a number of disputed states. And so just getting something bizarre to happen in Georgia wouldn't have made a difference. But there are going to be elections where one state will make a difference, as it has in the past. And, you know, if I think the danger here was that if you did something dramatic, like having a Justice Department run by someone really willing to do whatever Trump wanted in terms of crazy theories, announce a big criminal investigation of fraud, that very well could give the legislature of some state like Georgia the cover it needs to reject actual legitimate election results with accompanying chaos if the election isn't any closer. So that's why I think it's so scary. Yes, it would take a few steps before it comes to true chaos, where we have a election that is basically definitively not the will of the voters. But I think it's closer than most people are comfortable with.
The Washington Post is reporting on an internal debate within the Justice Department about whether to charge everyone who illegally entered the Capitol building during the riot on January 6th. Federal officials think about 800 people entered the Capitol, which is a lot of people to charge and try, and there's some concern about capacity in the legal system. Also, some of the people who entered the Capitol may not have had any premeditated plan to enter the Capitol or to cause specific havoc when they did so, may not have committed more serious offenses beyond illegal entry. And so there are some officials in the DOJ who are arguing to focus on those who conspired to bring about this insurrection, or on those who committed serious additional crimes once they got into the Capitol building. They're particularly focused on quasi-organized groups like the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers that may have been behind the planning that turned this into such a violent event. Now, the other side of the argument is about deterrence, that basically, if people think it's okay to storm the Capitol building and say you just got caught up in the moment, that might invite future riots. And so I guess, you know, first of all, is 800 really a capacity issue? We have a big government and a well-funded Justice Department. Can't they prosecute all these people?
It is absolutely a huge capacity issue. And I think people are blowing past too quickly why it is. So remember, there are two courts in the District of Columbia. One is federal court, United States District Court, where in which we see people charged with federal crimes across the country. So that court normally in the District of Columbia charges about 800 people a year. So to charge all these people, you are doubling the workload of that court, which is gigantic and causes it to come to a halt because it's not just courtrooms, it's judges, it's clerks, it's prosecutors, it's defense attorneys, it's probation and pretrial services. Every part of the system cannot take the capacity of doubling the number of cases you normally have, especially if you're going after extreme partisans under the light of history, many of whom are likely to want to push this to trial, even for misdemeanors. Because bear in mind, the system already grinds to a halt. If you have, say, 6% of people go to trial instead of 3%. So imagine doubling the number of cases and then having a very substantial number of those people want to go to trial to make a point about how they were saving Western civilization from the communist hordes, and it's completely unsustainable. Now, D.C. also has superior court, which is like state court in other places, and it's not quite as much of a capacity issue there, but it's still a very substantial one. D.C. Superior Court, based on the numbers I've seen, looks like it has more like, you know, maybe 3,500 people a year being charged with misdemeanors, like some of these that are being charged. So that's not doubling, but it's still a very substantial increase in the number of cases. I've seen people say, well, you know, obviously if these people were Black Lives Matter protesters or someone like that, instead of, you know, predominantly regrettably bearded diabetic white guys, that they would absolutely find a way to charge them all. Maybe. But I don't think you can blow past what a extreme and completely unprecedented strain to the system something like this is.
Do they all have to be moved through those specific courts? I mean, there's another federal courthouse right across the Potomac River in Alexandria, the Eastern District of Virginia. Can they sort of lend resources to each other?
Well, they can lend resources in terms, perhaps, of having prosecutors or even defense attorneys specially assigned, maybe things like that. But you can't be prosecuted in a district other than one where the government can establish that you committed some component of the crime. And that's particularly an issue. I've seen it suggested, well, you know, why don't you just say these people conspired to do this and then charge them in their home states? But the thing is, you don't want a federal jury necessarily in Kentucky or Tennessee to be making the call on this if you're the United States Department of Justice. You definitely want that home jury in the District of Columbia because you don't want people who agree with the people who are going in there saying, bring out Mike Pence so that we can hang him.
You say that because these folks are ideological, you think a lot of them are going to want trials. But some of the maximum sentences that I've seen thrown around here for the offenses that they committed are very high. Frankly, that often seem excessive for people unless they were real ringleaders of this riot. And so I assume there will be offers to plead out these charges for significantly less than the government could conceivably obtain at trial. So won't that be a strong motivation for most of them to enter plea agreements rather than insisting on trials?
It's always a strong motivation, Josh, in the federal system and the state system. But bear a couple of things in mind. First of all, maximum potential sentences that you hear in the news are complete bullshit, just completely divorced from reality. That is the statutory maximum that could theoretically be imposed. It bears almost no resemblance to any sentence likely to be imposed. The United States sentencing guidelines are sort of that we've talked about before on this show, are a framework of very complicated recommendations to the judge of what the sentence should be based on the background of the offender and the facts of the case. They are almost always much, much lower than the statutory maximum. Judges very rarely use their discretion to go anywhere near the statutory maximum. So those aren't the real potential sentences that we're talking about. Now, is there a huge incentive to plead because the sentence can be substantially higher if you go to trial? Absolutely. But part of that is based on the idea that if they want to, they can take you to trial. But the thing is, if a substantial number of these people say, I want to go to trial, then the system grinds to a halt. And when I say a substantial number, I'm talking about 2 to 3 times more than the minuscule number who normally do. So again, the system relies on this circumstance we have where 95 to 98% of cases plead out. It cannot sustain a substantially higher number of trials than that. And if enough people realize that and game the system to take advantage of that, or if enough of them are ideologically driven to want to go to trial, then you've got real problems. And these are exactly the type of people who go to trial despite the higher risks of going to trial and the higher likely sentence.
Is this something Congress could address in a fairly swift manner? I mean, could they pass a law that allowed, you know, certain prosecutors to be reallocated toward Washington, D.C.? Could they change the law so that Eastern District of Virginia judges could hear these cases, could sit in the court in Washington, D.C. and hear these cases? I mean, the capacity constraints that exist are a function of what sort of funding and personnel we have in the court system. I realize that it is you can't just staff up a huge court tomorrow if you had legislation today, but it's going to take some time anyway, some number of months to move this stuff through the system.
Sure. Well, I mean, there are already ways to have people assigned as special assistant United States attorneys in a particular district. There are already ways to have visiting judges come, but it's also, I mean, you need courtrooms, you need clerks, you need court reporters. There's just the mechanism that we use to shove people into prison is complicated and has a lot of moving parts. And it's really not something that is easily staffed up like that to the level we're talking about. You know, can the system manage it when you've got a couple of judges who retire unexpectedly, or you've got a surge of cases? Normally, yes. But a surge of twice as many cases as normal, that is unprecedented, historic, and very system straining.
I want to talk about one of the rioters who has brought suit against the government, Paul Davis, who's a lawyer in Texas. He was fired from a job as an in-house counsel because of his participation in the riot. And now he has sued the government, basically saying that, you know, because Joe Biden is not the legitimate president, there's no, you know, legitimate government here to bring, you know, I guess to bring prosecution against him. There's some sort of analogy to the Lord of the Rings here that's in his lawsuit. Is it normal to have like nerdy fantasy references in your lawsuits that you bring when you're a defendant?
Well, it's normal when I'm writing them. But no, I would not generally describe it as normal, and nor would the people who receive my lawsuits. This guy has filed a federal lawsuit that I would describe as the 2021 version of "Don't tase me, bro," except it's don't arrest me, bro. So it's a lawsuit, and it is completely crazy. It is Lynn Wood pants on head level crazy. The lawsuit says. This entire government is illegitimate. It shouldn't be exercising any power at all. Just like when, because there was no king of the kingdom of Gondor, the steward was appointed until the return of the king. And we should do the same thing. We should have a steward of Gondor, except instead of Gondor, it should be the United States. And stop making fun of me for saying this, is rather literally what the latest pleading is. One of the latest pleadings is a lengthy diatribe about people who are making fun of him for his ideas. It also includes something about how the court should prohibit the FBI from arresting him for his absolutely First Amendment protected activities with respect to the domestic terrorism that happened in D.C. So he's also changed his signature on these documents. And, you know, a signature block, Josh, in a court filing usually says, Kenneth White, Brown, White, and Osborne, attorney for plaintiff, whatever, right? But he's got it as Paul M. Davis, formerly employed here until wrongfully fired for his opinion, you know, words to that effect. Like he's basically got his crazy person's Twitter profile as his federal court signature block. I was really looking to see whether or not he was telling the federal judges in his signature block that he had been blocked by Rachel Maddow or something, because it would not feel out of place given how completely crazy his stuff is. This, even though you would normally sort of classify it as part of the trend we've talked about of performative litigation, this has more ring of sort of desperation to it. This stuff kind of stinks of flop sweat and terror, and it's got a good heavy few cups of sad mixed in with the generous helping of the chocolate chips of Schadenfreude.
Speaking of preparations for trial, the former President Trump's impeachment trial is going to proceed early in February. And the president has a lawyer with a fantastic name. His new lawyer is Butch Bowers. What can you tell me about Butch Bowers?
I had actually thought that Butch Bowers was the guy who was constantly menacing Encyclopedia Brown, but I looked it up and it turns out that's Bugs Meany. So this guy, along with another attorney that apparently President Trump has hired, another white-collar criminal defense attorney, is just a completely bizarre choice for former President Donald Trump. And I say that in a good way because they're really well-qualified and normal. So exactly not the sort of people that Trump has tapped in the past. Most Americans will not have heard their names, and that's a good thing. In a good way, because they're not crazy, camera cavorting, publicity hungry people who indulge their clients' worst instincts for doing crazy things for attention. They're sober, professional people who go in and get the job done. And that's a little surprising from this president. The other one, by the way, is named Deborah Barbier. They're both from South Carolina. Butch Bowers has represented multiple governors, for instance. He represented a former governor in the somewhat infamous Appalachian Trail incident that you might recall.
He represented Mark Sanford when Mark Sanford was threatened with impeachment as governor over that infidelity scandal. How quaint.
Right. And we don't like remember him for doing crazy things that we laugh about. And that's the point. These are highly qualified, skilled trial attorneys with good judgment and relevant experience. And it's just really strange for Trump to go after somebody like that, the sort of people he should have been using from the very start of our experience with him.
45 Republican senators voted to dismiss the charge against Donald Trump before the trial even began, saying that because Trump is not president anymore, there can't be an impeachment trial of him. And now, as we've discussed on the show previously, there's previous practice in the U.S. Congress of, you know, impeachment trial after departure of federal judges. And because the Constitution creates this remedy where you can bar someone from holding future office, it would be difficult to enforce that remedy if the defendant in the trial could block its imposition simply by resigning their office before the conclusion of the trial. But I just think it's remarkable how this goes to show that nobody really cares about these procedural issues, that people vote, you know, do they want a trial or not? And if they want a trial, then it's allowed. And if they don't want the trial, then it's not allowed. You also had some Democratic members of Congress who, when, you know, Republicans would say, well, we want to impeach Obama, even though he's not president anymore, they would say, well, actually, you can't do that. You can do that, whether or not it's wise to do it, or at least the clear balance of legal opinion is that you can do that, which is why Congress has done it before. But now you have most of the Republican caucus in the U.S. Senate on the record saying actually that can't be done.
Right. So this seems to be a fairly definitive indication that Donald Trump isn't going to be convicted in any trial, because 45 Republican senators agreed with Rand Paul that it would be unconstitutional to do so, that you can't do this. Now, if logic were involved here, you would say they would have to vote to acquit if they had already concluded definitively that this is something that's not constitutional that you can't do. So that, I mean, that seems to write the end of what's going to happen with the impeachment trial, and it's just going to be sort of something that drags out, we have to sit through to watch an inevitable result. You're right that the the strong, strong majority of legal opinion is that it is, in fact, constitutional. There was a very detailed and convincing letter signed on by about 170 law professors and legal scholars, everyone from Federalist Society members to liberals, a very non-ideological group, and the opinion of people who think that it can't be done seems limited largely to eye doctors who are also senators. A slightly more interesting question, but probably also a non-starter, is this argument that, well, you could decide not to vote to convict him, but vote to prohibit him from serving future office. So there's this theory that the Constitution allows you, even if you can't make a supermajority vote to convict him on the impeachment charge, you could have just a majority vote to prohibit him from future office. I think the weight of legal opinion is that that doesn't work, and that would be a bill of attainder, basically a quasi-criminal thing targeting a particular person, and that it doesn't make sense constitutionally. But that's also a theory that's floating around out there that some people who are, always eager to find any theory that they can are latching onto.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about a legal problem facing Joe Biden and some legal cleanup issues that Donald Trump has left behind as he left office. This is All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So let's talk about a problem facing Joe Biden. When Biden entered office, he issued this 100-day moratorium on deportations, essentially to give him time to review the immigration policies that had been set by the Trump administration, figure out what he wanted to change and who he didn't want to deport. And the state of Texas sued, and a federal court in Texas has agreed with the state, blocking the president's order imposing this moratorium on deportations. And there are basically two arguments here. One is that there's a law that says that once a final order of removal has been entered for a non-citizen, that the federal government has 90 days to actually remove that person. And so it's breaking that law to say, well, we're going to wait 100 days and not deport anyone. And then the other thing has to do with the Administrative Procedure Act, which basically sets out how the president is supposed to issue regulations and things he's supposed to do in that process. This is a thing that tripped up President Trump a number of times, including the former President Trump's efforts to add a question about citizenship to the U.S. Census. And so similarly, this judge said here that he thinks there's a significant likelihood that the Biden administration has not abided by the Administrative Procedure Act in the way that it issued this order. And so there's been this temporary restraining order issued in this court. It applies nationwide. Biden cannot implement this policy. It's remarkable how structurally similar this is to some of the problems that Donald Trump ran into with some of his own executive orders.
Right. It's the exact same arguments. Frequently, the things that Trump tried to do aggressively in the immigration realm in other areas were thwarted by lawsuits citing the Administrative Procedures Act, which is a federal law that sort of governs how federal regulatory agencies can change procedures and do new things. And the theories were often exactly the same as the ones here, that an agency can't create new rules that violate federal law passed by Congress, and that agencies can't create new rules that are arbitrary and capricious compared to prior policy. So this is pretty much a mirror of some of the arguments that have been made before. That's not to say that the arguments are equally as good or valid. It's just that this is the same mechanism. And similarly, what the judge did here was to create a nationwide injunction, not just an injunction in the Northern District of Texas where the case was pending. And that's been extremely controversial under Trump as well. Trump supporters were constantly complaining that federal courts shouldn't do nationwide injunctions, but should only do them in their own district. And liberals attacking Trump policies were saying the opposite. And so now it's switched. And to me, the opinion in this case has a certain level of just under the surface, good for the goose, good for the gander type rhetoric. But this is going to continue to happen. We're going to see the same techniques and arguments used to stop Trump, used to stop Biden. Here, amusingly, after this judicial opinion, Texas's Attorney General Ken Paxton, distinguished among other things for being under state indictment and FBI investigation, posted a very gloating tweet saying that this was a seditious left-wing insurrection, and my team and I stopped it. That referring to, you know, Biden's administrative, his executive order. So this sort of thing is going to continue to be a war and fought through the means of the courts, and it's going to be one of the ways to for conservatives to resist Biden administration policies the same way people resisted Trump administration policies.
I want to talk about some threads that were ongoing through the Trump administration that were either getting resolutions to or that were not. Now, first of all, the lawsuits over emoluments, alleging that President Trump was illegally receiving payments from foreign entities in the form of payments to his hotels and other properties. All those cases have been dismissed now. The Supreme Court basically told lower courts, go back and dismiss these cases as moot. He's not president anymore. We can't have a suit over emoluments. These cases started almost at the beginning of the Trump administration. And they spent nearly 4 years kicking around the legal system, and now he's not president anymore and they're moot. So is there any way that we could ever have litigation that would tell us exactly what the Emoluments Clause means and what it prohibits, litigation that would cause enforcement of whatever it is that the Emoluments Clause prohibits? If you can't get this done within a presidential term, how does that provision mean anything?
Well, Josh, if you wanted the rule of law to apply to President Trump, you should have reelected him, really. I mean, the additional 4 years might have given it time to get through the system. Now, this is one of the reflections of how successful Trump was in one of his core strategies, which was delay, delay, delay in terms of the court system. It was remarkably effective on a whole lot of fronts, thwarting any eventual outcome. So it may be that you could frame emoluments cases in a way to stop them from being moot. I mean, here I would think that one of the arguments could be that he continued to retain the benefits of his violation of the Emoluments Clause, enriching him, and that enrichment should be disgorged and he should be forced to give back some of the money. But, you know, as it happens, the plaintiffs in these cases apparently agreed that they were now moot. The cases were not, at least not successfully framed that way. If it ever comes up again, maybe that'll happen. I think it's more likely, though, practically speaking, that the remedy for this would be some sort of congressional action to pass a law with a mechanism for Congress to enforce the Emoluments Clause.
E. Jean Carroll, who accuses the president of having raped her in the 1990s, there's been this ongoing litigation. The president denied her allegation in extremely crude and insulting terms. She sued him for defamation, saying that he was falsely accusing her of lying about the allegation. And then there was this effort where the Justice Department said, because the president is a federal employee and because he issued this denial in his capacity as the president, that truly the defendant in this suit ought to be the U.S. government and not Donald Trump. And that would have led to the end of the lawsuit because the U.S. government cannot be responsible for defamation. And so this has moved around the legal system. The trial judge who was overseeing this case was extremely skeptical of the government's claims that they were the real defendant here, that when the president made these comments, he was doing that in his official capacity. And so there was some action that was going on that, you know, we were consumed with certain other things like the Capitol riot. But there was some action on this in December and January, and I'm wondering where it leaves the former president and E. Jean Carroll now that he's no longer in office. Now, first of all, this judge had said, you know, the federal government's not a party to this lawsuit. Why are you in my courtroom? And I guess even as late as, you know, just a few days before the inauguration, Friday before the inauguration, the Department of Justice under Donald Trump was still trying to get itself subbed into that suit. How does that work? If the judge tells you, you know, you don't even go here, How do you keep pushing that?
Well, you can try to do it in the appellate court, which is what's happening here in part, that the United States is appealing the judge's decision.
This is Judge Lewis Kaplan, by the way.
Right. We don't really know for sure yet what's going to happen in this because we don't really know for sure yet what a Biden Justice Department is going to do here. And this is something that happens every time you get a new president. You get this reevaluation of the Justice Department's position in high-profile and controversial cases. Often, the Justice Department decides almost as kind of a matter of policy to keep taking the same positions, and then it's detrimental for the Justice Department to waffle, even if the presidency does change. Other times, you have fairly dramatic shifts in the administration no longer taking the same position. You saw that, for instance, in some of the Obamacare cases, once Trump took office, the Justice Department taking radically different stances in litigation in which it was already a party. So I don't think that the Biden administration has yet announced what its stance is going to be in the E. Jean Carroll case. But it is not as simple as just Trump did this and it's awful and therefore we're not going to do it anymore, because the Justice Department has to think institutionally about how easy it wants it to be for people to sue the president of the United States in his or her individual capacity, because it's absolutely certain that that'll keep happening, not necessarily because of anything that these people do, but just because it's you know, performance of litigation is definitively a thing now. So I think they've got a not an obvious call here, and some of the precedent that the judge rejected here and saying the Justice Department couldn't step in was plausible. So I think it's a harder call than the people are making it out to be, and it would not shock me if the Justice Department continued to take the Trump administration's position in this one.
And then ongoing fallout from the pardons, the last-minute pardons that Donald Trump issued, there was a pile of them, and so it's taken people some time to dig through and figure out, you know, who exactly were all these people and how shady was it that Donald Trump pardoned them on his way out of office. And one of them, this guy Jeffrey Zangrillo, was a defendant in the Varsity Blues investigation, where people were paying bribes to get their children into universities, in this case, the University of Southern California. And so the pardon announcement about Jeffrey Zangrillo, who's a real estate developer from Florida, said that various people, including Tom Barrack, who's a casino mogul, who's the former president's business partner in the Trump Las Vegas, that he endorsed the pardon, Sean Parker, who founded Napster, that he endorsed the pardon. Now, these people say they didn't do this, and Barrack's people say that, you know, he was approached, but that he refused at every turn to endorse this pardon. It would be particularly awkward for Barrack because he's on the board of trustees of the University of Southern California. The pardon announcement also said various other false things, such as that Zangrillo's daughter was currently enrolled at USC with a GPA of 3.9. The university says she's in fact not enrolled there at all. So I look at this and I wonder, you know, the Trump White House made lots of mistakes. I don't know exactly how this false information got into the pardon announcement, but if it got in there because Jeffrey Zangrillo made various false statements to the Trump administration in the process of his effort to obtain a pardon, could that itself be a crime? And could the Department of Justice go back and look at the people who got pardoned and figure out if they defrauded the Trump White House, could they be charged with new crimes?
In theory, yes. So, 18 U.S.C. 1001 that we've talked about 1,000 times makes it a felony to lie to the federal government. And if any of these people lied to the federal government, that would be a problem. And ironically, 1001 is built in a way so that it doesn't particularly matter that Trump probably didn't actually rely on any of these lies. You know, it's rather clear that Trump and his people were pardoning cronies and people they liked and people they wanted to pardon. And I think it absolutely they would care if they were lied to about some of these things. But that's not the way 1001 is built. As we've said before, it makes it a felony to lie to the federal government, that the lie is the sort of thing that hypothetically could possibly be the sort of thing that would move the government, not whether it actually did in this circumstance. So absolutely, if they find that people told lies, then that could be a felony. I don't think lying about whether or not your daughter is enrolled and what her GPA is likely to be a material lie for purposes of a pardon application, but there could be material lies in there.
Couldn't it also be wire fraud?
Wire fraud, you need to be trying to defraud someone of money or property. So likely not, unless you...
Isn't the pardon a thing of value for wire fraud?
I think that's a tough argument, the way that wire fraud is written. And I don't think you'd go after such a tough argument when easier things like 1001 are sitting there.
there is some defamation news beyond the E. Jean Carroll news that we discussed. Dominion Voting Systems, which makes voting machines that didn't steal the election, but that various people around the president alleged had stolen the election. They filed another lawsuit. They're suing Rudy Giuliani for making these conspiracy allegations. And so first of all, they're suing Giuliani for $1.3 billion. And this keeps showing up in all the news headlines, a $1.3 billion lawsuit. Does that number mean anything? I mean, you can ask for any amount of money you want in a lawsuit, right?
Right. And it's traditional to ask for stupid amounts of money. And it's really, it's like, in fact, it's very much like news reports saying that this person faces a potential 20 years in prison. It has no relation to reality. So yeah, $1.3 billion here is something of a brag. It may actually be something that resembles the actual loss if a Dominion collapses because of all these lies, but it probably doesn't have anything to do with anything close to what actual damages would be, even if they won a lawsuit.
Well, but I mean, they could seek punitive damages, right? I mean, and Dominion is it's not just one person. It's a company with a very valuable business. So it makes sense that if you're thinking about, you know, how much money could you seek to recover in a defamation lawsuit, the financial cost to a large business of being defamed would presumably be larger than you would typically see with an individual.
Yeah, but it's so unlikely to be $1.3 billion. And punitive damages, Josh, have to be in part constrained by the assets of the defendant. You can't tag someone with a giant punitive damages award if they don't have assets. So with Rudy, you know, unless, you know, burst capillaries and ex-wives or assets that get counted, he doesn't have a $1.3 billion to go after.
Well, and so this is the same amount they sued Sidney Powell for. I would note that, you know, while Rudy Giuliani is not, for example, a direct-to-consumer pillow mogul, there is a direct-to-consumer pillow mogul who they may also sue. They've threatened to sue Mike Lindell. So maybe that's a deeper pocket there. But Mike Lindell is busy with his own defamation lawsuit. He has hired Charles Harder, who is, you know, defamation lawyer to the stars, basically bankrupted Gawker. And so he is representing Mike Lindell to sue the Daily Mail. Now, what did the Daily Mail do to pillow mogul Mike Lindell? The Daily Mail accused him of having secretly dated Jane Krakowski from 30 Rock. And it's this story about how they had a secret romance and her friends didn't understand what she saw in the pillow guy. Both Krakowski and Lindell deny that they were in a relationship. In fact, deny that they've ever met each other. But so Lindell says that this story is false and that it damaged his reputation because it said that he gave Krakowski gifts of alcohol. And Lindell is famously in recovery. And so it harms his reputation to say, in fact, he's, you know, he's conducting this romance and plying this woman with gifts of wine and liquor. So I guess, first of all, is that defamation if I like make up some like weird, funny story saying you dated someone you didn't date? Neither Lindell nor Krakowski is married. So, I mean, part of defamation is it has to be damaging to your reputation. Is it actually damaging to Mike Lindell's reputation if people think he dated Jane Krakowski?
I mean, I think that the theories he's articulating is that the little detail suggested you plied her with liquor or something like that. I mean, does it pass a motion to dismiss? Probably. You know, can you actually show at trial any significant amount of damages? I doubt it. But I mean, it's the sort of thing that doesn't make it legally defective. It just makes it stupid and embarrassing. You know, I think Jane Krakowski had the right response here when she said that, you know, she would have rather dated Kermit the Frog than dated Mike Lindell, which actually demonstrates a considerably more elevated level of judgment in men than her character described on showed on the show, if I recall correctly. But yeah, this is typical Charles Harder stuff. It's performative. It may have some strategic ploy in terms of getting into courts or getting discovery or something like that. That's actually something he's intending to use for benefits in other situations.
Really?
Who knows? Or it just may.
What's the discovery that you get about the Jane Krakowski rumor that ends up being helpful for Mike Lindell's much more serious legal problems around him being a proponent of these false theories about Dominion.
Well, if I were an unscrupulous lawyer litigating on behalf of a lunatic facing probable $1.3 billion defamation suits, I might use the discovery process in a different case to probe into things I wanted to find out about, perhaps arguing that this is all part of a vast conspiracy against me. So I should be able to use the discovery in the Jane Krakowski case to look into, you know, who is conspiring to plant these sort of rumors in the press against me. Could it be Dominion? And do that sort of thing, if I were completely unscrupulous and crazy.
So should we assume from this then that Charles Harder will be representing Mike Lindell for his defense if and when Mike Lindell is sued for defamation by Dominion?
I think it's probable. I think if you're a rich who definitely deserves what was said about you, but you want to sue over it, Charles Harder will be there for you. And I think it's likely he'll be there for Lindell on the Dominion case too, which is sort of the opposite.
There is much more that we could talk about, but I think this is a good place for us to leave it. Ken White, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more of All the President's Lawyers.